It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Each Saturday in the auditorium of the Homestead Library, a group of musicians meets to play music and carry on the rich tradition of local jazz. They came into being with the dissolution of the Black Musicians Union in the 1960s. Joining us now to talk about the Black Musicians Union, as well as the Jazz Workshop Group, and a showing of the film Local 471 about the Black Musicians Union, is Jackie Young, whose father, Harold, founded the group known as the Jazz Workshop. Thank you for joining us, Jackie.
Thank you for having me. I'm really pleased to be able to talk about the Jazz Workshop. So the Jazz Workshop started in 1973, and we have been going strong since. Recently, my father passed away, so I am basically taking over. It's bittersweet, but I'm happy to be able to keep it going because it's such a very important program.
And I want to talk about some of the motivation behind the founding of it. I also want to welcome in Pittsburgh historian Charles McAllister.
Good to be here.
Good to have you with us. And tell us about, Charles, tell us about the history of the Black Musicians Union. How and why was it formed, and where was it formed?
Well, Jackie might be better than I on that one, but we have had several programs over the years at the Battle of Homestead Foundation at the Pump House programs. Chuck Austin, for many years, was the head of the African American Jazz Preservation Society, and he really helped preserve the historical side of it, where the Jazz Workshop helped preserve the actual teaching side of it, the connection with the young people coming up in the neighborhood. But it was founded in 1908, so it was an old one of the original Black Musicians Unions, because there weren't many Black locals in the AFL in 1908. So it was real pioneering, and its demise was very tragic. But we can both talk about that.
All right. Well, let's get into the formation of the history of this and the formation of the Black Musicians Union back in 1908. And I guess none of us would be terribly surprised if this were the case, but were the big unions, did they exclude African-Americans who wanted to join, Jackie?
Pretty much what happened, from what I understand, is that two unions, there was the 60 and the 471, and the 471 typically focused on anyone who would come to town. Various musicians would come, and they were able to, you know, they had jam sessions, or they traded ideas. Now, with the 60, they did not provide the support so much. That's the reason why the 471 was erected in the first place. So then with the merger of the two, then there was not as much focus or towards mentoring for the younger people. So that's why the Jazz Workshop was formed.
Right. So as with many trade unions, there was an effort made to look at some of the mentor some of the up-and-coming musicians.
Absolutely.
In terms of how to apply their craft, but also to negotiate with those who were paying their salary or paying them for a
gig.
So describe how it worked.
Well, pretty much from what I have heard is that the 60 just didn't really want to represent the Black musicians. They didn't want to give them their share of gigs. They didn't want to represent them if they had some type of conflict. So that's why the 471 was erected in the first place.
Right.
Yeah. But the 471 pretty much was inclusive. But then in 1965, they merged. And so they were located in one particular building, one particular headquarters. But it took the focus off of the young African Americans being able to receive the appropriate mentoring.
And the Black Union Hall was an incredibly important center for people coming through Pittsburgh and playing here. I mean, all the famous jazz musicians played. We have so many great musicians here. I mean,
who were some of the members of the union?
Well, Mary Lou Williams, Ahmad Jamal. You have Billy Strayhorn, of course, went from here. But there were many, many. You can
Arter, Cecil Brooks, I think, was the president at one time. Cecil Brooks, senior.
So you had all of these great players, And yet, in some cases, they were not being paid fairly or on a comparable level with their white counterparts?
Well, I think what, you know, part of the white local was the symphony, was the downtown big bands at the time, and they had a whole different venue. They were in the big, the hotels, and were making much better salaries in general. But the black union dealt with the clubs, and it was obviously a more chaotic venues to deal with. But on the other hand, it was very, very strong organization. And if you wanted to play jazz in Pittsburgh, pretty much you belonged to the black local was very, very strong, and it enforced the fact that the people got paid and they got what the going rate was, and that was a very, very important thing. But even more important was the camaraderie in the club itself, where that was the heart of black jazz in Pittsburgh, was the club, and there all the greats would come. People Nelson Harrison talks about seeing, you know, Frank Sinatra would walk in with Ella Fitzgerald, and they'd sit down, and there'd be all these other great players just sitting around. It would go to 4 or 5 in the morning.
In Pittsburgh. Which clubs?
Well, this was the Union Hall.
Oh, okay.
But the Crawford Grill was there, the Hurricane, all these great clubs. They would close up at 2 or thereabouts, and then they would go on down to the Union Hall and keep going until dawn.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just imagining Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald. Can you imagine just walking in on that show?
For sure.
That's my goodness.
I wish I could have been there.
I think we all do.
And Pittsburgh musicians were so fabulous. Sometimes they would even intimidate the people who were coming to sit in. The Pittsburgh musicians would often change the key. They might lower it. Like if a song was in the key of C, they might lower it a half step just to throw people off.
Yeah, I guess it takes something like that. It takes a lot to intimidate the chairman of the board.
That's right.
Or Ella Fitzgerald, for that matter.
But Pittsburgh was a great stop between New York and Chicago. I mean, this was the great jazz center between the two cities, although Buffalo and other places had also important jazz centers. We learned a little history Wednesday. Dr. Harry Clark came, who's been very instrumental. He's took over from Chuck Austin as president of the African American Jazz Preservation Society of Pittsburgh. And he really talked a lot about the history of this organization and trying to keep alive the history side of it, which is what we'll do with the movie later on.
Right, and I want to get into that. But one thing I wanted to ask Charles and Jackie here about is apparently the members of the union were not all black.
Right.
Correct?
That's correct. Yeah. As far as I know, with regard to the 471, they had all types of people.
Right. What led to the dissolution of the Black Musicians Union in the 60s? As you said, it went all the way, Jackie, you said it went to 1965.
Around 65, yes. I've been told that basically they had the two different unions, but because of the Civil Rights Act of 1965, the merger, again, would not allow the emphasis to be placed. You know, the mentoring, black people weren't getting their share of gigs. They weren't being able to just get the focused attention, which was so important. So that's why the Jazz Workshop came.
So you're saying that when
the merger took place.
Right.
And the merger came down from the National, the American Federation of Musicians. They decided that the segregated, quote-unquote, locals, mm-hmm. although there were certainly white members of the black local, because they played that kind of music, and they played those kind of clubs. But the order came down from on high to get rid of the segregated locals. But in many cities, it was a very tragic thing because the larger white local took over from the smaller black,
which defeated the whole purpose.
Absolutely. It's sort of like when Major League Baseball got integrated.
Sure.
It wiped out the incredible Negro League reality, which was so important here in Pittsburgh. It was a great opportunity for individual ball players, but it was tragic in many ways for the black community.
We are talking about the history of the Black Musicians Union in Pittsburgh, which went from 1908 until the mid-60s, and the organization that followed, a group of musicians carrying on the rich tradition of jazz, the Jazz Workshop. And our guests are Jackie Young, whose father Harold founded the Jazz Workshop, as well as Pittsburgh historian Charles McAllister. You can join our conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Maybe you are of an age that you're able to remember some of the great gigs that happened in Pittsburgh in the past. Maybe you are a musician yourself and were a member of the union. We would love to hear your stories. You can share them with us. 412-246-2002. Our email address, esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter at esspgh, #EPLive. Charles.
Yeah, I'd like Jackie to tell us what's going to happen tomorrow at the Pump House with the Jazz Workshop. I think that's very important, and we really want folks to turn out and see this wonderful effort to keep jazz alive for the young musicians.
Okay, so tomorrow we will be performing at 1:30, the Jazz Workshop Big Band. The Big Band consists of a lot of great musicians, such as Dr. Ron Horton, who plays trumpet, Al Dowes on trombone, Nancy Taylor on the keyboard.
And
myself,
Jackie.
I'm Jackie. You are
a great performer yourself on the sax.
Well, you know, I do my best.
When did you first pick up the saxophone?
You know, I started playing the saxophone in high school. I went to Wilkinsburg High School, so I was about 14. And I loved it. I fell in love with it. My father played saxophone as well as my grandfather. Now my son's playing. So it's been kind of a tradition, and I just think that, you know, more children should be exposed to music, and that's why we're keeping the legacy alive in terms of mentoring, teaching music at the Jazz Workshop, which is at the Carnegie Library in Homewood, every Saturday.
And there are not – I know that the saxophone's a tradition in your family,
yes.
But there aren't a lot of women sax players, are there?
Well – they're starting to come out, you know, I think like Candy Dolfer, for example, a lot of people, you know, get excited. Or what is her name? Grace Kelly is a very good saxophone player. So a lot of, we do have another lady by the name of Laura Kaminsky, who's actually playing with the Jazz Workshop as well. And she said it made, you know, the Jazz Workshop enabled her dream to come true.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yes.
I know that's part of the mission. 412-246-2002. Let's go to Victor in Pittsburgh, who wanted to share some thoughts with us, memories. Victor, welcome. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, sir.
I had the privilege of meeting Carl Arter back in 1996 and took lessons on the saxophone from him and became very close friends with him over the years, as you do when you're taking one-on-one lessons from a great musician like Carl was. And he shared some thoughts with me about the union and his experiences. He said he took some time off of his musical career to work directly with the union, the Black Musicians Union. And he didn't tell me which local it was at the time, but it was during the 50s. And there was a good 8 years there that he did mostly union work. Mm-hmm. And I found it to be very interesting what he had to share with me. And some of the things you've already mentioned on the show, I was glad you mentioned and honored him in mentioning his name also, because he was a very big contributor to, as some of the older generation know, to the music scene in Pittsburgh. So that's all I really had to say.
Right.
Just wanted
you
to make sure he's not forgotten. That's all.
I studied with Carl myself, and he also was the teacher of the great legendary Stanley Turrentine. Huh. So, yes, he was definitely a great – he played saxophone for a while, but his main instrument was the keyboard. Yeah, but he was a great person. Thanks for mentioning him.
Yeah,
thank you so much, though. I have to go right now, but
thank
I appreciate
you,
getting me on the air.
You bet. Thanks for sharing your story.
Yeah, and I think that was very true in the 40s and 50s, really the golden age in many ways. There were the people who would work for the union, Black musicians, who would go out and find jobs and help clubs survive and make sure that there was a steady flow of talent and this whole thing of taking the elders and mentoring the young people was so important in what is basically an oral, with the ear tradition, mm-hmm. and not a written down music tradition. And there were blacks who were in 60, was in the symphony. I think Chuck Austin was one of the very first to break that line and get into the downtown local. So there were crossovers in both directions. There were, I believe, more whites in the so-called black local than there were blacks in until the 60s. That's when things began to shift, and more blacks got positions downtown in the symphony and other orchestras.
412-246-2002, if you, like Victor, have a story that or thought that you'd like to share with us. I do want to talk about the film. It's called Local 471. This is something that will be shown at the Pump House,
right,
on next Thursday, June 19th.
Right.
Tell us about this.
Well, I haven't seen it, so I can't really talk too much about it, and I don't think Jackie has either. So, but Dr. Harry Clark came to our breakfast on Wednesday and did talk about it, and he said it's called anthology because the goal was to make a series of films about different aspects of black jazz. So the first one, which is what they're going to show here, is about 45 minutes, and then there'll be a discussion led by Dr. Clark and by Ken Foley about the history of jazz in Pittsburgh. But the first one will be on the great piano players, Earl Father Hines, Errol Garner, Ahmed Jamal, on and on. I mean, we had such a great piano tradition. So that's my understanding, that's the first thing we're going to see.
Well, that's a good place to start with those piano players. Yep. They definitely were awesome.
Yeah, and when you bring that up, I immediately think of Errol Garner because I can remember being just a young boy and my parents breaking out those records and the Concert by the Sea. And I know he traveled all over the world and played, but talk about how, when he was around, some of the gigs that he was involved in and where you would go to see Errol Garner play in Pittsburgh. Do we know?
I'll have to rely on Jackie for that one.
I would imagine, there were a lot of venues in which people could play. I would imagine perhaps the Crawford Grill, maybe the Stanley Theater, places like that. I wasn't privy to them in a little bit.
Yeah, before all of our time.
But fortunately, I mean, there were so many places to play back in the day, and now it's they're few and far between.
What's happened? Why is that?
I just think people rely too much on maybe different types of music or DJs, and but I think the good side is that we're trying to keep it alive in terms of people learning how to play instruments and live music. We're trying to keep live music alive. So,
The Jazz Workshop, explain how that's really helping to fill a void.
Well, it fills a void in that every Saturday we're at the Carnegie Library in Homewood and we teach music lessons. We have wonderful teachers.
Is it Homewood or Homestead?
It's Homewood.
Homewood. I beg your pardon. I think I said Homestead. So
yeah.
Because the Pump House is out
right.
there.
Right.
So, but in Homewood. So I'm glad we clarified that.
Yeah. And so we've been doing that, the lessons, every Saturday forever, since 1973. And I mentioned that my father passed recently. There were so many people at his wake and at his funeral who just talked about how great he was and how, 30, 40 years ago, either they or their children or their grandchildren took lessons at the Jazz Workshop. There were so many stories about, I played the flute, or, my relative took a trumpet lesson, and it's magnificent. And we're really keeping that tradition alive. And so we have Ken Foley on the drums, teaches drums. Nancy Taylor teaches the piano. And Ron Horton is the band director. So we have not only the instrumental, but we also have the big band.
We have a couple more folks on the line who'd like to get in on the conversation. We'll start with Pam out in Oakmont. Pam, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. Thanks for calling in.
I'm calling from Oakmont, and I just wanted to pay tribute to my teacher, George Bacasa. I don't know if you recognize the name. He was a jazz flautist in the 60s. He used to play in clubs downtown. And, of course, I was in high school, so my dad would take me down, and I'd have a Coke, and he'd have a glass of wine. But George's day job was putting music to commercials. He worked in Oakland in a studio putting music to all the commercials. And then nights and weekends, he taught jazz flute and taught me how to play.
Wow.
Nice.
So I'm in my 60s myself, and I still have George's original flute. When he got a fancy one, he sold me his old one. So it has a lot of fond memories of learning how to play jazz flute.
Well, that's a wonderful story. Thank you for sharing that, Pam.
Yeah, and I still have one of his 45s. George, I don't know if anybody else knows him, but I have one of his 45s.
Nothing like the old vinyl, is there?
I know.
That's a great memories.
Thank you, Pam. Let's go to Ernie in Homewood. Ernie, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I just wanted to have some memories of the Zebra Room in Homewood, where Carl Arter was a legendary piano player there, and it was just a wonderful little place where it was a jazz scene and for years. And then one evening in the Pyramid in East Liberty, when the Pyramid was happening, I was in on a night that was just one of the most moving jazz nights. Now, I called them Young Turks at that time, but it was a young Jerry Allen was mm-hmm. playing, Cecil Brooks III, Rodney McCoy, Kevin Campbell, and all that night, these young, brilliant jazz people assembled, and it was just one of the most moving nights I've ever experienced in Pittsburgh. But it was at the Pyramid in East Liberty. And it was incredible.
How long ago was that, Ernie?
Well, this must have been maybe 80, mm-hmm. maybe 87, 86. Okay. That's the Pyramid. But Carl Arter, when I used to go to the Zebra Room, that was in the early 70s. And it was that where you had to go down the stairs, and it was that small, you know, wonderful little club in Homewood called the Zebra Room.
I remember.
Does anybody remember that?
Sure.
Actually, I was there once for a Rick Adams fundraiser, okay. I think.
And now Jerry Allen is back teaching at the University of Pittsburgh.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, she is. She's running the...
Yeah. 'Cause she made quite a name for herself as, you know, in the jazz world, you know. And because I remember one time on the Hill also, Jerry Allen was playing at the Tree of Art, and mm-hmm. I couldn't believe it, but Alex Haley was there that night when she was playing. I couldn't believe, because this is maybe just 3 years after Roots was really one of the groundbreaking, literary novels, and then it went to film, of course, and I remember meeting Alex Haley. So jazz always seems to bring out just a great influx of people.
Ernie, that's a great story. Thanks so much for sharing that. It's a great note to end on, and thanks for calling in. We appreciate it. It's been an interesting discussion, and I want to thank our guests, Jackie Young, whose father Harold founded the Jazz Workshop, and also Pittsburgh historian Charles McAllister. The showing of the film 471, local 471, will be next Thursday at the Pump House in Homestead, and the Jazz Workshop will be playing tomorrow again at the library?
No.
At the Pump House.
At the Pump House.
At 1:30.
See, this is why I got confused. Homestead tomorrow,
right.
Homewood most other Saturday.
Right.
Right.
All
it.
Right. Thank you both for joining us. We appreciate
it.
Yeah,
come
Thank
out and listen.
Coming up, we'll preview the 4th Annual Pittsburgh Jazz Live International Festival. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.
Daydream, why do you haunt me so? Deep in a rosy glow, the face of my love show.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The fourth annual Pittsburgh Jazz Live International Festival gets underway in 1 week, and you just heard jazz vocalist Diane Reeves. The festival consists of 3 days of jazz and jazz-influenced musical performances on outdoor stages and attracts more than 20,000 attendees from around the world. Here to help us preview the festival is WESA Jazz host Bob Studebaker. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Paul. Good to be here.
Diane Reeves, she is the headliner. Tell us about her.
Diane Reeves, if anybody, is the successor, if anybody could be, the successor to Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan as the premier female jazz vocalist. She is extraordinary. I saw her once about 6 or 8 years ago at a Billie Holiday tribute show, and there were other notable vocalists. Melissa Etheridge and Rita Coolidge were among those, and they were great, and the show was great. And then Diane Reeves came on stage, and it was as if the lights were turned on, and it was as if the electricity, it was just, she has such that intangible presence when she walks on stage. She's one of those people that has that extra something that the rest of us don't. And she's a great singer. So she's a great fitting culmination to this 3-day jazz festival. But it's over 240 musicians, 72 hours, jazz wall-to-wall in the cultural district. And a lot of people are really beginning to notice the economic impact that Jazz Live International is having. I recently had a chance to talk with Janice Burley Wilson of the Cultural Trust, who spoke about that aspect of the festival.
The Allegheny Conference identified the festival as a great way to attract people to the city. The restaurants that participate in the Jazz Crawl, they have their highest sales that weekend. 18% of the audience came from out of Pittsburgh, not out of town like Wexford and Cranberry, but Chicago, Detroit, New York City. They're traveling, they're spending money. It's a great audience, and so we're attracting national sponsors as well, like our new national sponsor is North Coast Brewing, the official beer sponsor for the Monterey Jazz Festival. And they called us. TGI Fridays called us. So the festival has been identified as an attraction and a recruitment tool to attract people to come to the city. And they're discovering Pittsburgh for the first time.
And what a great way to bring people here, huh?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, Pittsburgh, and you would know this as well as anybody, Bob, it's an incubator for jazz musicians. How did it come to be this way?
Briefly, it was something that was part of the African-American community in Pittsburgh. There were, and this is according to Larry Glasgow, a PhD professor of African-American history at Pitt, there were 10 symphony orchestras in the first decade of the 20th century in Pittsburgh comprised exclusively of African-American musicians. Mm. They ultimately formed a musicians union, and everything was segregated then. So this local 471, was the Black Musicians Union in
town. We were talking about that earlier.
I'm not surprised. It's a big part of our city's history and an important part. And 471 was the focal point of the jazz musicians. It was classical musicians who founded the union, but it didn't take long before most of those musicians had migrated to jazz. Jazz.
Well, that's interesting because I think that's an important part of the story that you knew about.
Yeah, it was when jazz came to Pittsburgh, it was heard by and then recreated by people who understood Mozart and Haydn and Beethoven. Hmm. And there was a sophistication to the level of jazz created here that was not common in other cities, where it would often be people who could play by ear and put something together. But it's why this town has such a jazz identity.
We have about a minute left, so maybe just enough time to talk about some of the artists that are coming to the Jazz Fest getting underway next week.
Yeah, no, there will be established artists like Diane Reeves and vibraphonist Joe Locke, but there will be a lot of people who are up and coming. Among them, and we're going to hear a little bit of them at the end of this session or segment, is Snarky Puppy, a band that actually formed at University of North Texas. Used to be North Texas State. And
oh, right.
Where Mean Joe Green went to college. And played
exactly.
Football. But they also have a jazz tradition there. There will be a jazz meets funk ensemble where Fred Wesley, who was with James Brown for years, his trombonist, is part of a band, and some Pittsburgh artists will perform with him. It's a very eclectic mix. It covers established artists, young up-and-coming people who haven't built their reputations yet, and it's a real point of pride for the city to have this.
Bob Studebaker is a jazz host here at 90.5 WESA, as if people didn't know that. And the Pittsburgh Jazz Live International Festival getting underway in 1 week. Bob here to help us preview it, and we're going to go out with what, Bob?
Snarky Puppy.
Snarky Puppy. All
Bent
right.
Nails, this is called.
Thank you, Bob Studebaker. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Have a great weekend, everybody.